This podcast contains sensitive topics such as murder, violence, and sexual abuse.
Hello, happy Monday. Well, I don't know when people are listening to it, but today is Monday for me, and it was a long Monday, and this is going to be a long episode.
You can file that under Nobody Asked.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Winstrand. I just love hearing your expert opinions.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, today we're covering the autopsy episode. It's not going to be as fun as the ransom note episode. I know everyone had a blast.
Ugh.
I'm sure it was shared, you know, millions of times by now.
Millions.
My expert analysis of the note was just like, mwah, you know?
Yeah. I don't know that that's an exact term I would use to describe it, but I think you had some insightful information. However, I really think a lot of people are going to be listening to it and be like, this is just a red herring. Anything you do to listen to this is just literally a waste of time.
Okay. First of all, the ransom note is never a waste of time. Ugh. It's always interesting, no matter how you splice it.
And
I really loved the comparison we made to I Am the Walrus by the Beatles.
Yeah, that was your idea, wasn't it?
Yeah, everything I say is brilliant and funny. I thought like that was the whole premise of this introduction. Anyways, before we dive into it, before Lindsay makes a joke, because I can feel her like trying to come up with a joke right now, I do want to say that I can look at you and know when you're about to like be inappropriate, and I could just like feel it. It's like sitting next to someone at a funeral and you know they're gonna get the church giggle.
You know they're gonna laugh.
Yeah, and you're just like, oh, please, please don't, please don't, please don't. On a serious note, we will be discussing the autopsy today. I just wanted to kind of like add some content warning to this because like obviously this was a violent death of a child, and the autopsy is going to reflect a lot of sensitive topics. So like, please listen carefully. And yeah, I know I said it.
Yeah, you said
I said it. Yeah. But please like, you know this going in that this is not going to be an easy topic. It's going to be hard to listen to at times. Going over the autopsy always makes me feel like a little bit sick. So I just kind of wanted to throw that warning out there, you know, before we even get started. I also like have my White Claw ready to go because the autopsy makes me want to drink a little bit.
Yes, obviously this was a disgusting, disturbing crime, even when you don't factor in some of the findings of the autopsy, just the fact that a kid was strangled in her basement on Christmas Day. I mean, it just get more screwed up than that.
Right. And, you know, one of our biggest aims of this episode is not to just, you know, waste time with science jargon, but it's also to kind of to clear up some misconceptions that people tend to have about the case, but also to talk about how even something as scientific as an autopsy has been debated by coroners and forensic pathologists. Like,
and people still is.
Yeah, no one can agree completely on it. So when we discuss, you know, the findings of the autopsy, we're discussing these experts and their opinions on it. And I want to tell you right now, like, they don't always agree.
That's true. And we're going to be kind of weeding through some of the information on the autopsy. It's about 7 pages. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's technically 9 pages, but two of the pages are omitted by that judge. So essentially another thing that makes the autopsy interesting is that 2 pages of it are not for the public to see.
Good.
And Dr. Wecht talks about that a lot in the book, that he is a forensic pathologist and can only analyze the autopsy to an extent because there are 2 pages that is censored by the courts so that the media wouldn't get their hands on it, because especially, you know, during that time.
Which you'd think they would probably want to censor the sexual abuse part, but I guess people were already speculating that. And a lot of the information was being leaked. I won't, you know, say by who I think was leaking it, but there was a lot of chaos in the police department about trying to just keep information private.
Yeah. And, Yeah, that was a huge problem. And so, you know, a lot of the reasons, I mean, at least I think a lot of the reasons that experts can't agree is because that there are pieces of information missing, but also they don't all agree on the sexual abuse part of it either.
Which is so weird because you'd think that would be pretty cut and dry. Like either it's intact and normal down there or it's not. But apparently there's a whole gray area that you can't really tell definitively.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
Yeah. Well, even like what happened first, like hitting over the blunt force trauma or the strangulation is often debated as well.
Right. And I always found that so weird because I know that, you know, they can tell if a wound was committed post-mortem, if there's healing going on, things like white blood cells or something like that. So you'd think they'd be able to differentiate between the two and which, you know, came first. But for some reason, there's still a lot of discrepancy about that.
Yeah. So Dr. Weck talks about that in quite a lot of detail on why he believes that the blunt force trauma happened after the strangulation. But often the narrative that is presented is the opposite, and we'll get into it. You know, let's
talk
autopsy.
I've definitely heard it both ways. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, where do you want to start with the autopsy?
So, I mean, immediately before we actually like really begin, it's important that everyone understands that when the medical examiner first got the body, everyone was under the impression that JonBenet was strangled to death. And, you know, the first thing that they noticed was actually a blunt force trauma to the skull that people did not know existed. Because you knew what I was going to say. Yeah.
Yes.
Because the skull broke, but the skin didn't. Basically, what I mean by that is that there was no blood.
Right. There was no laceration. The skin didn't break. So it wasn't obvious that there was a depression in the skull there.
Yeah. So that was a huge surprise in this, because they kind of assumed that it was going to be death by asphyxiation. And when it came time, and I guess the blow to the head was big enough that it would have killed her on its own as well. So that's where the, like, which one did it.
Independently, either one of them could have done it.
Right, right, exactly. And it's funny that we're talking about this because just today I saw someone post about this case in a Facebook group that I'm in. And they said that someone had hit her over the head and then quickly cleaned up all the blood. And that's why there was no blood there. And I was like, oh, no.
No, you Luminol senses cleaning products like bleach and blood. So
plus, I mean, in defense of the Facebook poster, if there was blood, I'm sure the victim advocates did clean it. But
like, there's all this red stuff. Let's just clean this up.
It's real gross. But yeah, so the first things first, they didn't know that there was a blunt force trauma until they were doing the actual autopsy, which adds just an extra bit of confusion into this case, especially the debate of what happened first, the asphyxiation or the blunt force trauma. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I've actually read through the autopsy. I have like a little annotated version where I, you know, like I tried to clarify some of the things in there that might be confusing. Like one of the first things I notice is they talk about petechial hemorrhages, which are like these very fine hemorrhages. And usually you see them in the eyes. And that's how, if you have a victim of strangulation, if you move back their eyelid and you see all these petechial hemorrhages, you can pretty much discern that they were strangled. So those were present in her eyes.
Okay, so meaning that, and I'm going to ask you clarification questions the whole time because though I did get a B- in biology, I never really took an anatomy class. And to be honest, anatomy kind of freaks me out. But what I think you're saying is that because we can see that, we know that she was alive when she was being strangled.
Right. I mean, that's so petechial hemorrhages can show up if you have like, if you're deprived of oxygen, whether that's, you know, you have a heart attack as well, I think sometimes can manifest as petechial hemorrhages. I'm not 100% sure what else can, but You hear it on any crime show. They'll always say they have petechial hemorrhages, which are the burst blood vessels. And they always explain that that accompanies strangulation. So essentially, there was definitely severe strangulation going on. That it sounded like just the presence of petechial hemorrhages can often be used to rule the cause of death as strangulation.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've seen that before, but I don't know when there's accompanying wounds. I don't know how that works. I'm not a coroner, but
so I do know that in the autopsy they do say like oh my gosh,
asphyxiation.
Thank mm-hmm. you. Yep. Is the cause of death.
Right, which is like me being, you know, me being like a layman that, you know, I've taken a lot of science classes. I definitely have taken anatomy and everything. I would have just assumed that it is asphyxiation because of the petechial hemorrhages.
Oh, okay. Interesting. And the book by Dr. Cyril Wecht, who let me put a pin in this for a second. Dr. Cyril Wecht is a forensic pathologist. He's extremely famous in the autopsy world because he has solved many autopsy cases, including he provided new evidence of the JFK at the autopsy, Elvis Presley. He did a whole special on Kurt Cobain. He is very well educated and he's well respected in that community. Megan, my wife, her mom works for a coroner, and I mentioned him and she knew who he was. Like, he is very well known in this community. And in his book about the murder of JonBenet, he said that the reason that they know pretty definitively that it was asphyxiation is that the white blood cells didn't arrive to the blunt force trauma, basically saying that she was already dead when the blow occurred.
Right. So white blood cells, their job is to navigate healing your body. So anytime there's a wound, whether that be, you know, in your bones, on your skin, wherever, white blood cells are the first on the scene. That's how you know the healing process has been started. So for example, if you were cut and then you died like 5 hours later, your wound would have already started healing. So we can tell that wound happened a certain amount of time before the death. So what you're saying is because there was no, did you say there were no white blood cells present in the blunt force trauma, or did you say there were?
There were either none or very, like, the very beginnings of the healing stage. But I'm pretty sure he says that there were no white blood cells around the hemorrhaging in the brain, which goes to say that she wasn't alive to have them rush over there.
So
if that makes sense.
Are you suggesting the blunt force trauma was post-mortem?
So again, like, that's the thing, right? And that's the thing that's highly debated. In the book, they think that it happened postmortem or very closely postmortem.
Like, she would already expire even right. if there was no blunt force trauma. There was no saving her.
Right.
That's horrible.
And the rest, I mean, obviously, you know, we're talking about an autopsy of a six-year-old girl. This is never going to get to be a better story. It's just going to get sadder as we go along. So misconception number one is that a lot of people believe that the blunt force trauma happened first. It's very possible that it happened first, but the autopsy and at least my source says no.
Right, and I always kind of wonder, in situations like that, how important is it to know which one happened first? Like, let's say, going to the intruder theory, if an intruder was in there and he was strangling the child and then hit her over the head, or he hit her over the head and then asphyxiated her, I mean, does that really change the narrative at all?
So, you know, you and I will cover an entire episode on all the different theories of this case, but there are theories that will not make sense if the blunt force trauma happened second, like the pineapple theory.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I really want to talk about that, but let's stick to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. We're only doing the one episode.
Triggered me just now. I'm like, yeah. Well.
We'll discuss all of the theories and all of the suspects of this case, but for now, to create this groundwork, we have to talk the autopsy.
So on the same page, page 5, it talks about the head injury that the child sustained, and it says there is found to be an extensive area of scalp hemorrhage along the right temporoparietal area. So temporal region would be where your temples are, and parietal is like the top of your head. Right. And that goes all the way back. And so it says in the right temporoparietal area extending from the orbital ridge posterior all the way to the occipital area. So the occipital area is actually like the lower back of your head where your occipital nerves are. So that's right. If you go along the ridge, like temporoparietal would be like the kind of like the ridge between the temporal lobe and the parietal lobe. So it would be like extending down the back of her head to the occipital region.
Yeah, basically to like, I mean, I can see you pointing where all of these mm-hmm. Parts are, but basically to the very, you know, back right above your neck.
Towards right. there, yeah, right. Along the left side.
Right. And so.
Sorry, right side. Sorry.
Right. No, that's fine. So the book by Dr. Cyril Wecht, when discussing the hemorrhaging in the brain, I gotta be honest, this fact, and I guess I'm going to use the word fact, but I mean, who knows if it's a fact or not, but this tidbit that he says, like, shook me to my core. And he said that the blood pattern in the brain and the hemorrhaging showed that someone shook her after she died. And that just like gave me goosebumps because, you know, it just kind of opens the door to a lot of speculation, obviously, like, you know, was it an accidental killing? And then once she was dead, you know, like you picture someone like shaking her, like, no, wake up, you know, like,
yeah, reviving that,
like,
her.
Panicky, like, thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That just
also was, like, violent. Well, no, I can't, not like shaking baby where you're like mad, but right. also I don't think you have to love a child to shake them to revive them. Like, you don't have to be a parent.
Yeah, but if you think about it,
brother,
if you think about it in like this context, like, this someone had grabbed this child, sexually abused them, and was like hurting them, you know, like in terms of strangling her, like hitting her thing. Why would you then shake to revive? Like, that seems like a really caring, nurturing thing to do.
Well,
not a panicked thing to do. Because even if it was a panic kill, like the kidnapping gone wrong situation, I can't see like a kidnapper botch a kidnapping and try to panic shake the victim. I would see them being like, oh shit, I gotta bolt.
But what you're failing to realize is that they might have been getting $118,000, maybe half of that, if the child was alive.
Okay, so then let me ask you this.
I'll let you.
If they felt that way, why didn't they take the body with them?
That's another really weird thing, is you would have so much more leverage.
Exactly.
But so here's the thing, like, even Lou Smith said that the entry isn't necessarily the window at some point. I don't know if he still sticks with that, you know, God rest his soul. But why, like, if you were able to navigate this, you know, 18 room mansion, like, why wouldn't you just throw the kid in the suitcase and walk out the door?
I mean, you wouldn't even have to do a suitcase, honestly. And we'll get into this like later, especially with like in the theories and the evidence thing. But let's not forget that JonBenet had a balcony attached to her room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that was kind of weird is they literally notate every single injury on this child's body, any that she wrote on her hand, all these different things. One of the things they talk about is there's a cheek bite on her mouth. And I just thought that was like, wow, they really go into detail and they mention everything. I actually put in my notes, was she just biting her cheek? Like, some people do that Some people do that when they sleep. Some people do it as a coping mechanism.
I would be interested to know, though, if they found that the biting had occurred that night, you know, suggesting that she was nervous or scared or whatever, versus if that was a regular habit that she had. I would be curious to know that.
Yeah, I think so. That's usually like an oral, oral fixation habit. People who like bite their nails, like to, you know, eat, smoking. I'm obviously not a kid, but she was not a nail biter. Her nails were really grody and too long. She hated trimming her nails. So I actually, if I could speculate, bear with me because I'm speculating, I would speculate to say she did not do that as a habit.
Okay.
Just because she didn't bite her nails. But she might have, like, one of my sisters doesn't bite her nails and she'll chew her cheek once in a while. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, oral fixations are oral fixations, but I almost feel like biting your cheek is, I don't know, easier than biting your nails. I don't know. I've never bit my nails, so like I wouldn't know.
Oh God, I know. You and your perfect nails. Yeah, I definitely struggle very much with nail biting.
Yeah.
After volunteering in a hospital though, I mean, that pretty much stopped.
Yeah, bad.
Oh my God. They say no palpable organomegaly. That means she has normal organs.
I'm really glad that you explained that because
okay. You
said a bunch of Dr. Seuss words just now, and I was like, what is an oogly boogly, and like, what does that do for us?
Yeah, and then, so that's, she had no rib fractures, no sternal fractures, so that suggests that someone wasn't beating her.
So the two marks that were on her back or her side, the ones that people always talk about being the stun gun, was that mentioned in the autopsy?
Yes. So stun gun / train track is what I labeled it as. So on the left lateral aspect of the lower back, approximately 16 and 1/4 inches and 17 and 1/2 inches below the level of the top of the head, are two dried, rust colored to slightly purple abrasions. So that would be two parallel dots that are about 1/4 inch apart.
It sounds like what they're talking about are two bruises, like the way they say it.
Right. So the rust colored, but it says two dried, rust colored to slightly purple. So that sounds like a bruise, but the indication dried makes it sound like, and also I think they use the word abrasion. Abrasion usually means a break in the skin.
Okay. Right. Okay.
So it says a light bruise. So the fact that it's not a fully brown bruise means it's not very healed.
Okay.
Right. It being slightly purple means it's more fresh than if it was like a brown faded yellow or something.
Right.
So that's probably fairly recent. Like that wasn't like from 3 days ago.
Right.
Yeah. So they actually don't say what they think it is. They just describe what it is. There's photographs of it. This coroner was a medical examiner, was very impartial about a lot of this stuff and described everything with extreme detail and care.
Yeah.
And did
very,
not
very objectively.
Yes. And so that's one of the reasons why the autopsy can kind of be pitched following multiple different theories, is because it's so neutral.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, when I read about the autopsy, I mean, I've read several books on this case, and it sounds like none of these experts agree on the entire thing. Like, you can get pretty close, but they always disagree slightly about something, you know? And that's partly what makes this case so frustrating, is that not only are you, you know, having conversations with people who think differently about what happened than you, but we're also citing the same evidence and interpreting it totally different.
Okay, so shall we cover the hymen page? Okay.
So this is where my handy notes come in. In the book, Who Killed JonBenet, by Dr. Cyril Wecht. Of all the books I've read, I think he has done the best job at describing the vaginal stress of the autopsy. So if I may discuss what he talks about first. So he basically said that everything he needed to know about the autopsy was said in the very last paragraph of the very last page, the last six lines. And he talks about the inflammation. Oh, just a quick side. Anyone who's listening right now who like again, we're about to talk about, you know, sexual abuse and violence of a child. So just to be aware of that. So he starts by talking about the inflammation in the vaginal wall. And because, so basically what the autopsy did was it broke things down into sections of trauma in the vaginal wall. And so Dr. Wecht says in one section, you can see chronic inflammation. And that's important because he says that acute inflammation is inflammation that has happened very recently. And chronic inflammation is inflammation that has happened within 48 to 72 hours prior. So what he's saying is that there was chronic inflammation on a section of the vaginal wall that was done 48 to 72 hours before she passed away. He talks about the thin samples of damaged tissue that when placed under a microscope, it shows vascular congestion. I feel super smart right now and nerdy, but anyways. Which means that there's more blood in the vessels than usual, which is a trauma response, like a physical. Yeah. So then he talks about, you know, focal areas in the vagina and how the smallest piece of tissue is in the 7 o'clock position of the vaginal wall near the hymen, showed erosion of the layer of tissue. And within that, a small number of red blood cells on the eroded surface, which basically is really fancy talk for saying there was an injury up by the hymen. Or unfortunately, in this case, the hymen was only partial. There's only a partial hymen. It was broken. But he's saying that there are a small number of red blood cells on the eroded surface proving injury, and along next to the by the hymen in the 7 o'clock position, there is acute inflammation, which suggests that there was sexual abuse just moments prior to her death. So he was saying, so basically he's saying that on certain areas of the vaginal wall where you see this chronic inflammation, you're seeing signs that there was repeated sexual abuse. And then when you're looking at the big question of, was she sexually abused that night, in the vaginal wall at the 7 o'clock position and the hymen is acute, inflammation, which suggests that she was.
So when I was going through this autopsy, when I saw interstitial chronic inflammation, I underlined it and I put inflammation. Does this mean UTI or abrasion, irritation? Because, you know, some kids, like I've taught hundreds of kids, like I know, you know, kids can be gross. And sometimes when they go to the bathroom, they don't really wipe very good. And that can cause a rash. If they get wiped too hard by a parent or something. But, you know, if you look at a diagram, the hymen is actually pretty high up, you know, so
that was the biggest point that he was basically suggesting, is that it's kind of one of those, like, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, because he was saying that though there's inflammation everywhere, this specific acute inflammation, in the 7 o'clock position is essentially, and I'm trying to point with my finger, but it's an entire finger's length inside is a 7 o'clock position. Yeah. So this is,
are you sure they don't mean like if this is a clock?
Well, yes, of course. Like that's the direction, but I'm talking about where he's talking about in the vaginal wall. So it would be like the length of, he says like a finger, not penile, but like a finger would be like right here in the vagina.
So in Stephen Thomas's book, he suggests that the injury might be more indicative of corporal punishment. Like if a mother, you know, her daughter wet the bed again or isn't wiping again, which, I mean, we could spend some time talking about Champagne's bathroom habits because I actually have notes on that.
Yeah. Oh, and we will.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Patsy Ramsey. I know she would hate that we are talking about that.
I know.
Steve Thomas says, you know, the injury might be something indicative of corporal punishment where, like, you know, you filthy child, they're scrubbing too hard, you know, whatever. Right. And, you know, learn right. to wipe. And
yeah. And, you know, I think what Dr. Wecht is saying is like, yeah, chronic inflammation in the vaginal areas could be like UTIs, bladder infections,
but poor wiping habits. But you know, they can test you for a UTI if they collect your urine and there's white blood cells in it. You have a UTI.
Oh, do they do that with this situation? Because, well, I guess you can't test urine that's on.
I saw a note somewhere when I was looking through it today that said they believe she had vaginitis, which is just like
yeah, I have read that.
But that would be important for the the medical examiner to know, because that could cause some inflammation in the vagina, like because the bacteria is all imbalanced and all that.
Well, but continuing on here, they say there's I'm gonna screw up this word. My apologies. Birefringent.
I think it's birefringent, but birefringent.
Birefringent.
Yeah. Foreign. Birefringent. Sorry, it's birefringent.
Okay. Birefringent. Foreign material. Also found in the vagina, which meaning a basically they put this under a microscope, and when exposed to Polaroid's light and observed through a blue prism, the material was silica, which is often found in lubricant such as talcum powder. And this suggests it's possible that the assailant was using a rubber glove, or that talcum powder was being used to soothe an irritated area. So, like, if she did have
a rash,
a yeast infection, a rash, or anything like that, perhaps they were using talcum powder to help with the irritation or to lubricate the area.
Isn't it weird how they can't choose between the two because they only have silica?
Right, right.
Well, and, another thing I saw is, I don't know if you're going to get to this part, but they found the presence of cellulose.
No. What do you mean by that?
That's where they say they think she was, what's the word? Sodomized with a paintbrush.
Oh yeah.
Because cellulose is only present in plants, trees. It's not present in the human body. We can't even digest it. Like if you ate bark, you would literally just go straight through you. Because you can't digest cellulose.
I didn't know that at all.
Okay.
About the autopsy.
Well, I didn't see it in this autopsy, but I've heard of that before. And I'm sure you've heard people say that she was sodomized with a paintbrush.
Well, yeah.
Patsy Ramsey's paintbrush.
So surprisingly, like, he doesn't really talk about that.
Well, that's something you'd have to take a swab for and then
right.
be like, what's that? And then look at it under a microscope and be like, oh, that's a plant cell.
I do think that, you know, the paintbrush and being penetrated with the paintbrush thing.
I mean, that's about a finger length.
That's true.
But there would have been presence of the vaginal fluid on a paintbrush.
Oh, that's a really good point.
All you have to do is shine a black light.
Which I'm sure they did, yeah.
Which I'm sure they did, looking for blood or semen.
Right.
Was not found at the scene. No semen.
It's very possible that that might be a misconception of the case, and I might look into that a little bit more to see where that idea came from, because that's another one that I see a lot. And I personally have never really read about it. I've heard of people theorizing about it because of the nature and the violence of the crime. But that's the kind of thing I'm just going to have to put in the inconclusive evidence pile. And when we do our evidence podcast next, the fourth episode, we should dive into that one a little bit more.
So I'm also in some of my notes, it says there was blood on the labia majora, blood on the clitoris area, which, and also semi-fluid, what does it say? Dried and semi-fluid blood is present on the skin of the fourchette, which is like the sensitive area, like the, you know what I'm talking about? Okay. But it does, like, it says blood. It doesn't say whose blood, probably hers, right? I mean,
presumably, yeah.
Presumably. And I put again, UTI. I mean, why would you have blood all over your clitoris if you had a UTI?
No.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it can get really irritated, though. Like, the whole fourchette can get irritated if you have a UTI, if it's, like, rampant and untreated.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I really think, like, you know, I'm just some, like, stupid person out in the world. If I can look at this and say, oh, UTI, I'm sure if that was relevant, they would have run a quick test.
Right, yeah. Well, okay, and remind me after we're done, like, you know, talking about the actual autopsy documents, because I do want to talk about what her pediatrician had to say about it, as a little bit of a devil's advocate. But the last thing that Wecht talks about before I stopped reading the book, because I stopped understanding, is that in the acute inflammation, the ones that are like up by the hymen, they said that there was no inflammatory infiltrate, which meant much like the head wound, the white blood cells did not rush to the scene to heal the body, and they were not found in this area of the vaginal wall because she had died before the white blood cells could cultivate, suggesting that she died within the hour of the injury.
So that's interesting because on the last page, there's a sentence that says there's no evidence of inflammatory infiltrate or organization of the hemorrhage. Subarachnoid hemorrhage is also identified. The subarachnoid space is like under your cranium. You have the dura mater, the subarachnoid, and then the pia mater. So it's just it's a layer of the meninges. It's like it surrounds your brain. So it like keeps your brain like nice and lubricated. It's the meninges. That's yeah. So I mean, she got hit in the head and there was no healing because there was no evidence of inflammatory infiltrate on the hemorrhage. Right. So that was what you were referring to earlier.
Yeah. So those were the two biggest parts of the body that they didn't find the white blood cell. And so that suggests that she died too quickly for the white blood cells to rush to the scene, which also shows that that acute inflammation up by the hymen had to be pretty fresh because there were no white blood cells on the scene.
Right. Like if it happened 2 days before, it'd be healing up.
Right. So the pediatrician, and we'll talk more about the pediatrician because he comes in quite a lot because for those who don't know, JonBenet had quite a few doctor's appointments in the years before her death, and he was astronomically upset with the autopsy report, and he thought that people like these like medical examiners and forensic pathologists were all wrong, and he was like, there's zero sexual abuse, and to basically discount them, he was like, yeah, she always had UTIs, and I just found that really weird,
right?
Because like, and he went on to say, you know, she had terrible like hygiene practices and that none of that is unusual, and that, you know, like he used almost like accusatory language, like, well, she's the one who was super unhygienic and she's the one who couldn't stop getting UTIs. And like, I think all of that actually helps the case of sexual abuse a little bit more, because a child going to the doctor that much over like vaginal distress,
right,
like a little telling, and for him to have such an adverse like reaction. And then when asked, you know, like, oh, but like, how can you know that there was no sexual distress unless you did some kind of like a pap smear or anything? And she was obviously too young for that. And he was like, well, yeah, she was too young for it, so I couldn't ever do that. And it's like,
Right. Right. So and like I've seen, I actually saw a pelvic exam done on an 8-year-old before. It's not something that you really do unless you suspect there to be sexual. I'm telling you, that is not something that you just do, like just to check it out, make sure they're okay. That is not a routine inquiry at all.
Well, and he tended to kind of like insert himself in this case quite a bit. You know, he was the same doctor that, you know, told the police to stop asking to interview Patsy Ramsey because he had just prescribed her anxiety meds and she like is not mentally well, like enough to answer the questions. And it's like, man, all that's good and well, but like, why are you inserting yourself in this case so much? Like, why are you getting so aggressive?
Isn't that beyond the scope of your like expertise?
Right. I mean,
perhaps. Well, so she visited the doctor 18 times for little accidents, like hitting her eye, bonking her head. But I read somewhere today, and I wish I actually wrote down the source, but it said they cited more visits because they went back a further amount of time. So the 18 times is, I think, in 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this other one said 27 times. So obviously that could have been her whole life. That could have been 3 years.
Right.
But they said 4 of the times were for pelvic related things, which UTIs, rashes. Well, some people are just way more prone to getting UTIs.
Yeah.
Especially if you have bad bathroom hygiene, because if you don't wipe properly, bacteria can climb from the anus up to the vagina.
Yikes.
Also, if you wipe wrong as a female, if you wipe back to front, if you're doing that and you're listening to this podcast, you need to stop. If you're wondering why you get UTIs and always have vaginitis, that's why. Stop doing that. PSA.
Thank you, Dr. Winstrand.
Okay, stop calling me that because people I'm not a doctor. I'm pretty sure that's a felony to call yourself a doctor.
I'm so sorry, Detective Winstrand.
Detective. Okay. Well, I mean, you can call me Detective Fleet White.
Man, I know. I miss him. There's no reason for us to talk about him in this episode, thankfully, but
yeah. So one thing I highlighted on page 3 of Jean Bonnet's autopsy is it says a 1 centimeter red-purple area of abrasion is located on the right posterior lateral area of the 1x1 hymenal orifice. So that's literally fancy doctor talk for abrasion on the opening of the hymen.
Can you, just for like a quick second, kind of describe like what exactly the hymen is and its function?
So the hymen is a flap of skin that you can see in someone who has not had sexual intercourse or other reasons that their hymen might be damaged, which would be like an accident, some kind of stretching, masturbation, mm-hmm. You know, so it's not only from sex that the hymen gets torn. So it's like a flap of skin that can get torn and it usually bleeds. Like that's why I think, is it in the, like biblical passages or other religious books where that you're supposed to bring the bloody sheets?
Oh, right.
Where the hymen's after, torn.
Yeah. After you, not congregate. What is it?
Consummate.
Consummate the marriage. Yeah.
Right. So
weird.
Yeah. I mean the function of the hymen, I'm actually not sure about it. I just know like that's, you know, a lot of cultures, it's really important to preserve your hymen. So you can be married as a virgin.
Okay, so I just wanted like a quick clarification because they do discuss the hymen quite a bit and like the location of it and the injuries around it.
Right. So the types of injuries you're describing, it sounds like, so like they always say like, oh, you can tear your hymen riding a bike or riding a horse. Like those are always the two most common ways people describe other than sex to tear your hymen.
Right.
So, I mean, the types of injuries they're talking about are actual abrasions. So I don't know that that could be something that hit the hymen and caused it.
Right.
Or if the hymen just tore on its own. Like, I think you can actually tell those injuries apart, but I don't know for sure about that.
Well, yeah. And, you know, if I'm not mistaken, it is in this area that they didn't find, like, the white blood cells rushing to the scene.
So there was an indication that there was an injury on the hymen, but there was no indication of healing.
Right. And that's kind of, I was kind of making a diagram in my brain of how this is working because, you know, as we've talked about, experts debate whether or not any sexual abuse happened whatsoever. And that includes that night or any previous sexual abuse or reoccurring sexual abuse. Like, this is not agreed upon with everyone. And so I just want us to kind of throw like what accurate information we have out there. So thank you for answering that, because I was trying to conceptualize this and figure out exactly what this is telling us.
Right. And also, I don't know if this is within the scope of relevance of what we're talking about, but in Stephen Thomas's book, he does talk about how the autopsy indicated ongoing sexual abuse.
Yeah. But not, you know, not everyone agrees with that.
Right. That's what's so weird.
Well, I mean, honestly, prior to you and I talking about this, me as someone who used to know nothing about the autopsy and very little about that part of it, I would have sworn up and down that there wasn't sexual abuse at night. And we've talked about it. I've been like, that's not, right. That didn't happen.
Right. Well, I remember you bringing that up to me when you kept like rambling about pineapple and I didn't understand why. You're like, there was no sexual abuse. I was like, yes, there was. And that's because there's so many different interpretations of the facts, right, that are out there that you can't really land on in a theory of whether there was or not.
Which is so funny that a month ago I would have been like, I'm 100% sure that there was no sexual abuse at night. And now I'm like, I'm 100% sure that not only was there sexual abuse at night, but there was reoccurring sexual abuse. And it's like, how did we get here?
Yeah, I don't know. I have like really mixed feelings about it. But what I do find really odd is, this is probably the fourth time I've said in Stephen Thomas's book, but that was like that was my favorite source so far. He talks about how the Ramses, you know, they used to do these really long negotiations to get an interview with the Ramses. And it was like beyond what was normal to negotiate for. And one of the things the Ramses demanded was that the police department publicly retract the statement that JonBenet was experiencing ongoing sexual abuse. And they refused to do that because that did not align with the facts that they were collecting.
Oh my gosh.
I know. But that looks really bad, especially if you were not abusing your kid sexually.
Well, and again, like when we talk about like the subjective things that have happened in this case that are unusual, it's like, well, on one hand, like they're grieving parents whose child died and the world thinks that they did it. And not only that, now they think that the world thinks that like they were sexually abusing their child all the time. So if you like didn't do it, like that's got to be mortifying. And if you did do it, that's got to be mortifying. So like, right, it's hard to even analyze what that could mean, because both of those situations would spark the same like similar reaction.
So I believe it was, I don't know if it was when they went to collect non-testimonial evidence from Patsy Ramsey. I don't think it was. Maybe it was, but soon after the autopsy, they informed Patsy Ramsey that there was evidence of sexual abuse, and she was hysterical. Like, she was in shock. She couldn't believe that. I mean, that's literally like every mother's worst nightmare. I mean, next to like your child being fucking strangled in your basement, like that's your worst nightmare. So it's
absolutely.
I mean, Patsy Ramsey had like a really rough life. Like, when I see her in interviews and she's just like so put together, I'm like, man, I think if most people experienced like a quarter of the pain and dread she did, like they wouldn't have made it.
I know. It's so hard. This whole case is so difficult. I wish that everyone could agree at least at like one thing of this case. Like, it's just wild to me that even an autopsy, like something like scientific and something like to the point, is like still debated, because it could be like this vaginal distress, you know, is it molestation? Is it chronic sexual abuse that was ongoing?
Is it a rampant UTI?
Right. Is it corporal punishment? Is it wiping too hard? Is it having bad hygiene? Like, it's just so hard. And the only thing I think that we can all agree on is that, like, this poor child, right? Because, like, regardless of what happened that night, like, in terms of, you know, what happened to her physical body, like, it was all just terrible. Like, point blank. There's just no way around it. It was just all awful. And, you know, anyone listening, I hope you like, you know, sometimes I too have to be reminded that we're talking about a 6-year-old girl.
Yeah, you know? So it's like surreal. Like I teach 6-year-olds to play piano. Like they're so little. It's horrible.
Yeah. And finally, the last thing that we absolutely need to talk about with this autopsy, and it is something we have not brought up yet at all because it's for this part, is that a big revelation that they found with the autopsy was undigested pineapple. And the reason that this is so relevant is that it completely throws a wrench into the timeline of events, because so it was undigested, right? Like there was like,
right. So basically when you digest something, it goes into your stomach, which has like a really acidic pH of like 2, I think, is hydrochloric acid in your stomach. And then it goes to basically like your small intestine, and then which takes out the minerals and vitamins, and then your colon, which sucks out all the water. Right. So if they had found it in her colon, they could say, okay, so she ate this, you know, 2 hours or 3 hours ago, however long it takes to digest food. You know, everyone's a little bit different, but they can kind of backtrack it based on the location. So I'm pulling up right now. It's probably one of the last pages that they mentioned the pineapple, right?
Yeah. And, you know, while you're looking that up, I just want to specify that this is an extremely important part of this case. And the reasoning for that is the timeline of events has the Ramseys putting JonBenet to bed as soon as they got home.
10 o'clock.
At 10 o'clock from the White's party. The White's did not serve pineapple at all in any variation at their party. They had like a seafood platter. And the existence of pineapple in her stomach that was undigested, which essentially means she ate it very like soon before
perimortem.
Yeah. Shows that at some point she had consumed pineapple when they got home. Now, when asked about pineapple, the Ramseys claimed that there was zero pineapple involved. She went straight to bed. However, and we'll extrapolate this on this in the next episode, the reason I'm so mad at the victim advocates is that
they took out the trash.
Yeah, and there was a bowl of pineapple on the kitchen that had Patsy's fingerprints, and next to it was iced tea that had Burke's fingerprints on it. So when I said in the first episode that the kitchen was an important part of this investigation, that is what I was talking about. So, I mean, obviously that's very speculative of me. But what I'm essentially saying is that if something occurred in the kitchen with the pineapple, that could have, not saying it did, but it could have been cleaned up on accident by the victim advocates.
Potentially. I mean, that's why it's important to really preserve a crime scene, you know? It's actually page 5 of the autopsy where they discuss the pineapple.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, for me, the pineapple is the thing that pretty much puts every theory to bed. Like if it's the intruder theory, the intruder, you know, snuck her downstairs after using a stun gun and then fed her pineapple, like, and then put Patsy's fingerprints on the bowl and Burke's fingerprints on the tea next to it. I mean, anyway, so one of the notes I have, it's paragraph 5, and they're talking about the GI tract. The esophagus is empty, which would be like where you swallow, right? So like if she choked or something, like her epiglottis would be, you know, moved a certain way, and then she would have like aspirated the food, right? So they always check for stuff like that. So her esophagus is not obstructed. Down here it says the proximal portion of the small intestine contains fragmented yellow pieces. Yellow to light green tan apparent vegetable fruit material, which may represent fragments of pineapple. So that means it was in her small intestine. So it had made it past her stomach. Because what's interesting is I wrote here, so it doesn't really say how digested. Stomach acid can digest it for a little bit after death. So what that means is like, it's literally acid. So if you were to leave pineapple sitting in acid, it probably would have just literally disintegrated. But what happened is it made it through her stomach and has been sitting in her small intestine, which would be responsible for like absorbing nutrients. So that's why I say perimortem, because that means like around the time of death. You don't really know like how much before.
Well, and there, the pineapple always throws a wrench in this every time.
Always.
There have been theories I've thought about, and I've called Lindsay and I'm like, what about this theory? Like, I just thought about this. And it's like, oh, but what about the pineapple?
Right.
Does that like make sense with the
pineapple? Recently, I said, what if, you know, there was an accident in the car and she was hit with the flashlight by, you know, allegedly by somebody in the car that they had just gotten at that Christmas party or something. Or she was struck in the head in the car and they thought she was dead. Sorry, mm-hmm. They thought she was sleeping, but she was actually dead.
Right.
And they carried her upstairs to bed. And I was like, oh my fucking God, I solved the case. Like, I couldn't believe it. I literally solved the fucking case. And then I told you about it and you're like, but she had pineapple in her stomach.
But the pineapple.
Right, but she had pineapple in her stomach. So obviously she was awake at some point, whether that was. Well,
and, you know, of course I've been asking people their own theories about this, and the pineapple always like kills their theories too. Because I was talking to a coworker today. I was like, do you like podcasts? And she was like, no, not even a little bit. And I was like, well, you'll like my podcast. And she's like, what's your podcast on? And I was like, the JonBenet Ramsey case. She's like, oh my gosh, I'm actually like really obsessed with the JonBenet Ramsey case. And I was like, oh, okay, like what do you think happened? And she like gives me this really elaborate, like, what she thinks happened. It was definitely her own theory, you know, of events, like, just, like, little things that she's picked up, and this whole timeline, like, really thought a lot into this, and then when she was done, I was like, look, I don't mean to break your spirit, because I can tell you put a lot of thought into that, and you feel like you know what happened, but it couldn't have happened that way because of the pineapple.
Which, you know, there was pineapple on the counter. So if JonBenet was asleep, as they said, although in Burke's weird interview with the child psychiatrist, he said she helped carry the gifts in.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the detectives didn't really
put too much into that
because he was like little and he probably.
Well, and he can also just be remembering a different time that they've come home. Because like
right.
The accountant has always been that she fell asleep in the car on the way home and they took her up to bed, like they carried her to bed that night. And that has never changed. Like when they introduced the pineapple situation, they were like, not to our knowledge, like this is what happened. So the pineapple always throws a wrench into everything.
Well, if she was asleep when they carried her to bed and everything, and she woke up later and Burke had a snack of pineapple that he may have fetched himself, that his mother may have fetched for him, and he just left it on the counter because like kids are lazy brats. And she might have just like come downstairs and grabbed it at some point.
Right. You know? And, like, you know, we will talk like really in depth about all of that in the theories portion.
I just don't know what else there is to do on the autopsy, to be honest.
Well, I think we covered the three major areas, and that was the cause of death. Let's just do a quick summary. So like the cause of death, how we, you know, and again, we're talking based on like experts that we have read about have claimed that it was death by asphyxiation and the blood force. Yeah, as the official cause of death in the autopsy. Like that is 100% what's in the autopsy. And then the blunt force trauma to their head, there was no blood because it didn't crack the skin. It just cracked the skull underneath. That's like really important because, again, I saw that on Facebook today. Of someone with this like wild theory about all the blood from the head injury, and it's like no,
yeah, that's not a thing, guys.
Yeah, so you know, cause of death is what we covered, and then we talked about the physical trauma. Yeah, the physical trauma to the vaginal area within the vaginal wall, the 7 o'clock position near the hymen, and we talked about the acute versus chronic inflammation. Make of that what you will. I hope anyone listening kind of like, you know, listens to this objectively and kind of, you know, makes up their own mind about that. Because again, it's disputed. I mean, it goes back and forth. Everyone kind of disagrees on it. And then lastly, and arguably one of the most important things that we find out, and I just like one added thing here is that when the police didn't secure the house immediately, And I think a lot of it's because they kind of thought they knew what happened. Like, someone broke into her bedroom and took her. I just, like, need to specify how important it was that they should have closed down that house, because now, with the existence of pineapple in her stomach, we do know that, like, other rooms were being utilized during this time. And that's why this whole house, the entire house, regardless of how insignificant you think something is, needed to be, what's the word?
Properly maintained.
Yeah.
Just, no matter how insignificant it seemed at the time.
Exactly. And that's just, like, my biggest takeaway from the autopsy, is that there was one story that was going on and the autopsy showed a totally different one. Anyways, I think we're going to get ahead of ourselves if we continue talking, so maybe we should end here.
Okay.
Because I can already feel myself being like, oh, you want to talk theories?
So, well, well, well.
You know? So since this was a particularly, like, you know, down episode, why don't we end on a happy note? So I've listened to other true crime podcasts where they'll say, like, one good thing that happened this week. That way it ends on a more of a positive note. So why don't you go first?
Oh God. I'm a very negative person.
I know you really are.
I'm like I can make any situation very negative. So that's my positive thing this week.
What was the highlight of my week? I got to see my in-laws this weekend and we actually had, like, a really good time. Like, I had, like, a lot of fun. We had, like, dinner, we had drinks, we played euchre. Me and so my mother-in-law has a boyfriend, and he and I drank an entire fifth of Jameson cold brew. So I got pretty, like, fucked up pretty, and I didn't expect to get, like, so drunk there. But it was nice. It was, like, kind of nice to just, like, unwind like that, you know? Yeah.
And, you're like a workaholic, man. Let loose.
It's not that I'm a workaholic. I think I'm more of, like, a hobbyholic, where, like, I want to work a lot, but then when I have time to just, like, sit around, like, watch a movie or relax, I'm like, oh, I have to, like, I want to create a new trivia game today, or, like, haven't done a podcast and, like, do a podcast, or, like, maybe I'll make a bucket list. Maybe I'll plan a trip. Like, it's more of that.
Yeah.
So,
can I redo my happy thing? I think my happy thing was I got to watch Unorthodox, which is about a Hasidic Jewish woman escaping the community.
That sounds really interesting.
It was amazing. And I started that book on Audible.
I'm going to write it down. What did you watch it on?
Netflix.
Oh, really? So it's just, like, a Netflix movie?
It's a Netflix original miniseries, and it's only one season, and they have no intention of making a second season. Yes, my heart is breaking. That's that cracking sound you're hearing.
So I have the day off tomorrow, so maybe I'll watch it. But
oh my God, I watched it all in one day. My sister, Nicole, has watched it four times. The fourth time she watched it with me. Oh my God, yes. But she watches the same stuff all the time over and over. Like, she's
so great. I do have the day off tomorrow, so maybe I'll watch it. But then watch again, it. Like, knowing me.
Look me in the eye.
You're going to talk to me tomorrow and be like, did you watch it? I'm like, oh man, I would love to, but watch I decided it. I want to learn how to fly an airplane. So, like, now I'm doing that.
Like, I'm starting another podcast. I already filmed three episodes.
It's the anti-JonBenet case.
Oh my God.
Where we discuss everything except for true crime.
Oh my gosh. I love true crime. And man, like, I went on this double date with my boyfriend, and he was like, oh, I met this guy at this, you know, bachelor party. He's actually related to my sister's husband's side.
Oh, weird.
He's like, so, like, it's like someone that, like, I should be normal around. And he brought his, like, very sweet girlfriend, and I don't know what the fuck is wrong with me. But and this was a while ago, but the first thing I said when we sat down is they said something about how, you know, this tank nearby, because we were at a Chinese seafood restaurant, there was this tank nearby, and they had, like, I don't know, somehow the alligators came up, and I told them, hey, you know, people think a good way to dispose of bodies is to toss it to the alligators, but you can't do that in winter because the alligators are hibernating, and they won't eat the body, and that's how they caught Scott Peterson.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he dumped her body around Christmas, and the alligators don't eat.
Right.
Because they're hibernating.
And so that was, like, the last time you saw them?
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, it was. It's really awkward. And, like,
I like felt so ashamed that that's the first interesting thing I had to say. I was like, what is wrong with me?
Oh, I will say too, another good thing that happened like this weekend was I finally, after years of searching, have found a leather jacket that fits me perfectly. I'm really like specific about leather jackets, and I don't like when they're too short or they're too big or they're too long or anything. And we were like, we went to an outlet mall, and I was walking past this like window display, and I was like, that's the one. I was like, that's the one. And we went in, and they had one in my size. And wow, it was 50% off, and I didn't even know it when I grabbed it. I was like, I don't care how much this is. I'm going to buy it right
that's
now.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it was. And when I got to the thing, she like rang me up, and it was like $100. And I was like, okay. And she's like, oh, actually, it's 50% off. And I was like, wow, this was an excellent moment.
You're like, can I just pay $100 for it?
Like, seriously, she's like,
can I just spend my money?
Please subscribe. I guess I would love to make a case for why we should, you should keep listening to us, but the longer we do this, the more
being harder
it's. So subscribe, download all the episodes, even if you don't want to listen to them. Send it to all your friends and family.
Just play them while they're on mute. Just do us a solid.
Right. Like, just send it to every single person you know. Like, kind of think of it like an MLM, but for this podcast, like where you post on Facebook, like, hey, lovely ladies, like today we have this podcast. Like, just do that all the time.
What's an MLM?
Multi-level marketing.
You might want to see a doctor about that.
No. You know those MLMs, like you've seen on Facebook, like people being like selling like Lululemon, like, ugh, yoga pants and like makeup and shit like that, you know. Ugh. Anyways, okay, I'm gonna mute.
Okay, well, everyone, so
that you guys can get some peace of mind. But you know, I hope you guys continue listening. The next thing we're gonna talk about is the evidence, and we're gonna lump them into categories of what is factual evidence, what is physical evidence, and what is subjective evidence, and also like misconceptions about the evidence.
Gosh, I think you just listed 4 different episodes because it's gonna be heavy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We'll get to it. Mm-hmm. As for now, I'll let Lindsay sing you off. But do a different kind of singing.
Do a different sing off. Yeah. Okay, give me a second. Let me channel my inner musician. No one would ever believe that I have a music degree. Like, based on the. Goodbye, 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 goodbye. That's it.